Hi, everyone. This is Kyler from Feeding Matters. Coming to you on August 22nd is the 2025 Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit. This year, we're going deeper. We're hearing from more professionals. In fact, we're going to hear from all four domains of PFD, as well as the two domains from ARFID. And we're going to look across lifespans, starting with neonatology and going all the way to adulthood. Most importantly, we're highlighting the lived experience. So if you want to come together with other professionals who are engaged and dedicated to serving families and children who struggle to eat while hearing from those families directly, this is your opportunity. We'll see you on August 22nd.
Presented by Feeding Matters with host Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom.
Feeding does matter.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Feeding Does Matter. I'm Jacqueline Peterson, CEO of Feeding Matters.
I'm Haley Estrom, and I am an associate professor in the School of Nursing at UNC Wilmington.
How are you doing today, Haley?
I'm doing pretty well. There's a little bit of a thunderstorm rolling through, so you might catch a little bit of that. How are you, Jacqueline?
I'm doing pretty well. We are in our series where we are bringing on speakers from the Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit to talk about their background, how they got into this as a specialty, how they collaborate with their team members, and just to give a little sneak peek as to what you'll find at the summit. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Natalie Perez and Dr. Melissa Anderson, who are presenting at the Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit on August 22nd, Building the Foundation, a Holistic Interdisciplinary Approach to Infant Feeding. One of the things that is so different about Melissa and Natalie is they came from such different lenses and perspectives and settings and kind of found their way to each other and work in collaboration together.
My background, I actually got my doctorate in school psychology. I knew that I wanted to work with kids and really, really focus and specialize in early childhood development. And so I felt that was a good path. I chose a program that was pretty heavily clinical as well. So that's how I sort of got myself into the more clinical pathway. And, you know, I really early on was a big fan of behavioral peds. Eating, sleeping, pooping was my jam. And, you know, pretty much still is. and, you know, I just kind of gravitated more towards pediatric psychology. And that's where I got my postdoctorate and fellowship training was heavily in pediatric psychology and working with children who have medical issues and really understanding the dynamics and the interplay between biological, physiological, environmental, you know, psychosocial factors. And I found myself in the NICU post, in fellowship, but then really after my first job was in the NICU. And that's where I really got interested in and really dove headfirst into developmental, neurodevelopmental care of infants and in the NICU and premature and medically complex babies. I found my way to the University of Michigan, CS Mott Children's Hospital, which is where we both work now. And I partnered with the psychologist that were running the feeding program here at the time. It was a more traditional feeding program where there's outpatient and also intensive outpatient options. And, you know, we had found ourselves just unable to make our way through the long wait list. We had, you know, 400 patient 4-year wait list. We partnered together on writing a grant to help with preventing feeding disorders, really kind of revamping how infants are fed in the hospital and then providing support outpatient, because we found that over half of the patients that were referred to and ended up on the waiting list for the feeding disorders program were before the age of three. So all of the patients on the wait list, three and under, they all had come through our NICU or our cardiac unit. And so we knew we had a, you know, sort of a pipeline in a population that was at much higher risk. And we really wanted to see if we could help target that. And I think this is a good time to kind of segue over to Natalie.
Yeah, that makes sense. Natalie, what's your background?
I have a much more like traditional and I think direct route to feeding. My PhD is in clinical psychology, and I started out really in the more traditional autism, parent training, behavior management world. I did a practicum at Michigan, and that's where I sort of fell in love with pediatric psychology. So sort of the same thing, really fell in love with behavioral peds, the sleep, poop, behavior. And then I found feeding, and feeding was sort of this like perfect blend of everything for me. And I loved the population and just continued to specialize in it from there. So I did my internship at Marcus Autism Center, and then I came back to Michigan. And I think in a series of kind of unfortunate events, but fortunate in some ways, that's kind of where my path and Melissa's path sort of intertwined. Mm-hmm. And like she said, we're very complementary, you know, to each other between my traditional behavioral feeding background and then her NICU expertise. And for many reasons, we were sort of thrown into this, and it was like a sink or swim kind of thing. And the more that we
those are always working, the best learning experiences. Just...
I don't think either of us probably want to repeat it, but I will say that you are 100% correct that it was probably the best thing that could have happened, like from a learning standpoint. And that's sort of how we came together, and under Melissa's like supervision really helped me to foster the confidence to sort of blend what I knew and what she knew, and got to really learn this population. It was kind of a sink or swim kind of thing, and really able to blend what I had learned with this new population. And I think many things happened at the same time in order for us to build the program that we have now between, I was a relatively new mom at the time, which completely changes who you are as a person, as a clinician, your approaches. I had also been following a number of kids that were much older that I had been following since they were younger, using a more traditional approach. And I took a step back looking at it as a mom, as a behavioral feeding provider. And I just had this moment where I thought to myself, this can't be it, right? And I had a really good rapport with these families. And I just was really transparent with them. Like, what do you want? Because now I'm looking at this from a completely different lens. I'm looking at the, you know, now we see these infants, and now I'm a mom, and now I have this going on, and now I see you, and I see your kid, and I see this struggle and this pain in a different light. It's no longer just, well, let me give you these like standard recommendations, and gosh, why are you having trouble following through? And it's like, well, of course you're having trouble following through because I was blind to it, right? It's one of those things where you don't know until you know. And when I knew, it smacked me in my face. And I knew that I wanted to do different. And I knew that I wanted to be different. And it's not that there isn't a time and a place to use some of those other interventions, but I think it has become my goal, and it's become Melissa's goal, to do the most that we can and follow a holistic and preventative approach to reduce the likelihood that we'll have to follow some of the more traditional like intervention paths. And so far, I think it's really working, and we're really excited to share that. And we're hoping that this will sort of give people maybe a similar light bulb moment of taking, taking a step back and being able to admit what you don't know, because if you're not always learning, then you're not human, right? We have to always be learning, and there's always something to learn from our patients. And, I think Melissa and I were lucky enough to sort of have this opportunity to sort of blow up what we thought we knew and do better. And so, yeah, I think that's a lot of information to share about who I am, but I think it really is a really big part of it, because that is a huge motivation behind why we built the program that we built and how we grew it from, the grant into what it is now.
Well, I love it. And I think it's such a great example of how not only does care evolve, but how you as an individual evolve within care that's evolving, within a research landscape that's evolving, and all of the other pieces that are involved. And it sounds like you two, in creating this together, have been able to really learn from each other and challenge each other to figure out what does that evolution look like.
It's true. I think also, she kind of mentioned this like perfect storm, right? Where it was just all these different pieces kind of came together all at once. But what I think was really great is that, with the clinic, with the grant that we had or that we were rolling out, it was very heavily focused on prevention, being proactive, being prevented, preventing the preventable, right? And when we're working with infants, neonates, babies who have, who are born with medical complexities, we're really cue-based. We're really working on keeping all of the stress and discomfort separate from the eating experience. And as we were working through this, and as we were kind of building this, we started learning and realizing a lot more that it doesn't just apply to the babies. it's and feeding is a developmental milestone, just like walking and talking. And we wouldn't expect, a one-year-old who had really never had chance or opportunity to practice going up to a stand, trying to, balance on their feet. We wouldn't expect them to just start walking just because they turned 12 months, right? Or, we wouldn't expect an 8-month-old who really had never been able to be on their stomach for tummy time to just start crawling because they're 8 months. And, we know that the development of oral feeding from the start is very sequential, and it builds on the next. And if there's disruption in one of the early steps, if you don't have that in place, you're not going to just jump over to the next one. And you're at so much higher risk of developing that aversion. And then you have so much more to work through in order to actually be able to do the things to build those skills. And so it very easily spirals into this thing. But if we learned, that what the foundational components are, we learned over time to really make sure to ignore, the age and really focus on where they're at developmentally, what they're ready for physiologically, developmentally, and really work from there. And we learned that that is a really, really good recipe for not just for infants, but for just young children in general.
Yeah,
And I think
I agree. Sorry, go ahead.
I think it what it took was my background and like the neonates and like that, the early feeding, oral feeding acquisition piece. And then Natalie's piece of, seeing afterwards really what happens and how it develops and what needs to be done in order to undo all of those years of conditioning and, the delays. And so I think just having her lens of knowing feeding so in depth, but then also having this like last, I think, piece of the puzzle where it's like, okay, this is the early feeding stuff. This is how it's learned and how it develops and how it progresses. I think that is really just kind of what finally kind of put it into place and really helped our program expand beyond just that smaller, I think, concept of what the grant was intended for.
Yeah, I just wanted to build off of that. We often joke around that we're like some of the worst psychologists around, especially in the realm of feeding, because we don't do feeding as like typically is done within psychology. But she always reframes it. She's like, no, we're just not doing operant conditioning. We're focusing on the classical conditioning piece, right? So we're trying to manipulate all the different variables around the infant to increase the likelihood that they're going to want to engage in feeding. So whether that's, you know, working, I was actually just talking to somebody today about the importance of co-regulation in feeding.
Yeah.
Right. Where I was, some of the questions were, do you wear your baby? How often are you noticing hunger cues? You're not noticing hunger cues. Your baby's going from 0 to 100. Let's work on some skin to skin. How are they regulated outside of feeding? Because that's so incredibly important, right? And if you would have asked me 5 years ago if I would have considered co-regulation and skin to skin and how that would impact feeding, I'd have been like, what are you talking about, right? I'm just looking at feeding as feeding, but feeding isn't just feeding. It's everything else that's around feeding. And that's what we're looking at manipulating. And there were several patients in the beginning, like I said, I was kind of thrown into the deep end of infant feeding. I had never done NICU work. I had never done infant feeding, but I knew behavioral shaping and chaining and all of that. And I knew general feeding, and I relied on Melissa to sort of help me fill in the gaps. And there were a couple of patients in the beginning that I failed with. They ended up developing aversion. I did fix it quickly because they were young enough that like I could correct much more quickly. But it gave me an opportunity to go back and say, like, where did I mess up? Like, what did I miss? What were the gaps that they didn't get? Or yeah, what were the gaps? Like, what didn't they get because they were averse? And how can I make sure that doesn't happen again? And we were able to identify patterns pretty quickly. And I think that's sort of, you know, where our psychology background too comes into play. Like, we're able to look at all of the different variables at play and say, oh, okay, now I'm going to try it with the next patient. Oh, that worked. Okay, cool. Now I'm going to try that again. And, you know, after time and time again, we sort of put together, you know, sometimes it's like the Harry Connick Jr. song, like, you know, that's a recipe for love. It's like, this is the recipe for preventing feeding disorders, is sort of what it's like this. I don't want to say it's a plug and play because it's always different, right? There, but it's within the same recipe. It might be a little bit more of this and a little bit more of that, but you still need the same components there, which is really making sure that they're getting lots of exposure and opportunity, and we're addressing psychosocial factors and they're comfortable. And, you know, we'll talk about that in our presentation, sort of this hierarchy of what are the different factors that you need to be considering as a provider, because if one of these isn't addressed, it doesn't matter how good of a provider you are, you're not going to make progress, or you're going to be faced with significantly more behaviors. And I had a provider this week tell me that oral aversion is a behavior, and they need to go to therapy for it. And I said, behavior is communication, and your job is to ask why. Why is that behavior there? And if we address the why, not just the behavior, it's going to give you a completely different lens. And in this specific case, the why is that this kid had a stroke and he's not hungry, and now he's on seizure medications that suppress his appetite. You can go to therapy all you want, but if he's not intrinsically hungry and motivated, I can't force him to eat. And if anybody tries, that's highly inappropriate.
Yep.
So let's address the root cause.
Yep.
Because a month ago, he was 100% oral feeder prior to all of this stuff happening, right?
Oh, yeah.
So it's not just, so I think that's what we're really hoping for people to gain to from our presentation, is sort of looking at why is this happening? Where are the gaps? What can I do as a provider to move?
Yeah, well, and you've done a great job of really sharing how you're busting silos almost between disciplines, because I think Oftentimes, when we're looking at something, it's from our own particular lens, and we know how complex feeding is. And just like you were talking about, it takes everything and it's so many things. And that's why it's so complicated to be able to have this communication that happens across team member, across discipline, or across like different professionals and family members that are involved in a child's life, because you don't know if you're talking the same language, and you don't know what the whys are if we're not asking the right questions. So I just love that perspective of being able to think broader, and acknowledge the complexity and be able to work on navigating through it. So I love that that's a component of how you all will be sharing your model. Haley, yeah.
And well, I heard you mention co-regulation. That's something that my mentor studied and did a lot of work with. That Susori, that's just it's funny that you mentioned that. And so Jacqueline will know that I talk about establishing joint attention and doing things like that in meetings. And Sue talks about or studies infant feeding and NICU, and I love that you mentioned that.
It's huge. It's a huge piece of it. And even outside of feeding, right? A dysregulated baby outside of feeding is not going to be a regulated baby inside of feeding. And so sometimes we spend many sessions just it's not that we're ignoring oral feeding. It's that I know that I need to spend a majority of my time focusing on this other piece too. And I think this also goes into what you were saying, Jacqueline, is how important interdisciplinary care is. And one thing that we've emphasized from the very beginning of the program, and this was something that we spent so much time on, was bringing all of the disciplines together and truly collaborating and working together. So, right now we have a model where we co-treat together in one visit with an SLP or OT and with a dietitian. Sometimes we even have a GI on the call. We have a nurse practitioner we work closely with. We also have a very well feeding informed pediatrician that we co-treat with. Now that we're 2 years into the program, I will say that we're so well versed in communicating with each other, and everyone sort of knows enough about each other's discipline that now we can see patients sometimes more independently, or maybe only two of us and the other one backs out, because I think they're it, with feeding, it ebbs and flows, right? There's going to be times where psychology is more involved. There's going to be times where I'm not as needed, but this is where I really need my SLP OT colleagues to step in. And I always say, take us home, like take us over the home plate, because we've got the foundation down now, and you can just continue and work your magic from like a skills perspective. But in terms of that sensory piece, that regulation piece, that's a lot where our OT colleagues come in and are so beneficial. And again, I will be the first to admit that I didn't used to think that there was utility in some of these things, and I was sorely wrong. And I will admit, and that's sort of how we developed the rapport that we did with the other colleagues, is just being open and saying, we're wrong. Everyone needs each other, right? And I think one of the things that I realized the more that I listened to them was, oh my gosh, of course you weren't able to be successful as a single discipline, because it would be impossible to do this alone. And we all need each other. And it's not just one is better than the other. Like I said, it is this true ebb and flow of when different disciplines are needed and when one needs to like step up and really address things. And
You're so right, and I do really appreciate your transparency and openness about how you've addressed maybe past considerations, because I think sometimes it's hard to see beyond our own worlds. And if you did have like a prior experience of thinking about a different discipline a certain way or a different method a certain way, it can be hard to figure out like what's the value in that versus like maybe what are the things that I want to leave behind. And I just appreciate how open you are, and you can tell that that's one of the values that you two hold and probably your whole team holds in terms of how you collaborate, how you work with others, and how you work with your families.
Yeah, I think one of the coolest things is that the other disciplines have given us similar feedback. Like, I used to think that you just did this.
I was going to ask that. Yeah. Has it gone both ways?
It has. We have received nothing but positive feedback from the people who have participated in the program. And we've worked really hard to not have even a siloed feeding program, because I don't want knowledge to be at the top, right? I want to spread knowledge out as much as possible, because that, one, it just increases access to care. Two, I just don't feel like there's a reason for just a small group of people to hold all of this. There's so many kids that need to be helped. And so, you know, at Michigan alone, we have 4 or 5 sites where there's, you know, OT and SLP. So we have partnered with OT and SLP at those 5 sites. We'll also work at the with the dietitians at the different sites. Our dietitians are directly embedded within the medical teams, which provides us with amazing rapport with the providers of these, you know, specialty, within these specialty clinics. And we've also started partnering with community providers around the state, so they have access to our knowledge and we can collaborate with them. We're really trying to sort of break down any siloed care, because it is impossible to treat these kids alone, like I said. And you know, to go back to the point of, we have only gotten positive feedback about how much they have learned from changing their view. Like, gosh, we have one of our amazing SLPs. She's just phenomenal. And she will say, you know, I used to have these babies that would come in and they had reflux and they were vomiting and I was never able to be successful. And I would try to push through because that's the only thing that she could do, right? And now she's like, no, this needs to go and get fixed, but she has some place to send them. Mm-hmm. And then we fix it and then we send it back and she takes care of it in 2 visits, right? She fixes flow and positioning and all of the magical things that she does. And everyone is happy, right? But now, again, the lens is different. She will say, I never would have thought that I needed to address that first. I just tried to address what I was taught to address. But now everyone approaches things from a much more holistic perspective. And it's just really amazing to see.
Yeah. I think it also helped. I often view feeding. I love metaphors and analogies. I mean, we are all about it. But I think one analogy that I keep coming back to is, it's, you know, feeding development and progression is like building a house. And that's why we use the foundation analogy. You know, just like building a house, you have to start with a solid foundation. You can't put the framework, you know, all the wood and the 2x4s, and that's as far as I get in terms of technical terms, but you can't put that on if the foundation's cracked, or if the concrete isn't even dry yet. You know, it's going to collapse, and you can't build a second floor until that first one is built and solid. And so it's the same thing with feeding. It's sequential. And if you don't have certain prerequisites or things in place, you're not going to be successful. It will collapse. It will go wrong. You know, there's just very certain things that have to be in place before you can even think about the next thing, because it can't happen until this is in place. So I think that's why it's also so important to have a truly interdisciplinary approach, because feeding is so multifaceted and there are so many different systems and things that need to be in place in order to be able to progress. It's physiological, it's sensory, it's skill, it's safety, it's, you know, it's psychosocial, you know, it's all of those things. And if one isn't in place, it is going to impact the other. And none of us specialize in all of that, right? There are these literal discrete specialties that, you know, have that in-depth knowledge and training that we have to draw off of, because if that isn't in place, we are going to miss something and it's going to collapse. So that's why we can't be successful in a silo. And there needs to be that smooth flow, in and out, emphasizing one specialty or multiple at a time, because it's all necessary.
Yeah. And you make a good point about being able to bring someone in. And I think having and knowing that team member to be able to like refer to and having a basis for that relationship is really important. And I know that that's not something that all of our professionals have out there. Mm-hmm. And that's what ends up being a huge challenge for a lot of both professionals and families that are out there. But so valuable when you're able to make that happen in collaboration.
Yeah. If I could just, make a recommendation to listeners, it would be send an email. So because we were a virtual program, we see patients from all over Michigan. So some of our patients that we follow are 6, 7, 8 hours away. I can't ask that family to come and see our in-person providers, right? So they're seeing someone local, and that local person may or may not have a lot of expertise in some of the medical complexities that are going on with these kids. And there's a couple, pretty discrete areas, relatively speaking, that I think we'll get pockets of kids from. And so I've just started cold emailing providers saying, hey, do you want to meet? Do you want to learn about our program? Tell me how I can support you. Here's my email. So if you do get one of my patients, please email me. I'm happy. If you're seeing something that maybe is not being reported to me, let me help. Let me help fix that. If it's reflux or constipation or something's going on with the parents or whatever. And I have yet to have somebody say no, right? They're always so excited and open. And I've even just filled out their patient stuff on their website, right? Like, hey, if you're interested, just shoot me an email. And I think we've got a lineup of meetings over the next couple months to form relationships with providers that are up north and, on the west side and all sorts of things. So I think just email, form the connection or make a phone call, and people are willing. And usually it's just, you just got to take that first step.
Is this one of the big areas where you see care going over the next few years?
Yeah, well, I actually, our goal amongst many, many other goals, I would love to create a statewide program that would be more like a consultation kind of program to be able to provide consultative support to pediatricians, to OTs, to SLPs. And, my pie in the sky idea would be that we would have a core interdisciplinary team that, the OTs could contact our OTs, and, we could have, Michigan has this amazing, it's called MC3. It's this psychiatry program where pediatricians, I think, Melissa, I'm right, pediatricians from across the state can contact psychiatrists here at Michigan Medicine and get consultation on, medication and things like that, right? Because we have such a specialized program here, and I would love to replicate that, because knowledge is power. And like you said, just knowing who to contact, just knowing who to ask, just having a different lens or a set of eyes or someone to refer to is a really, it's 90% of it. It's not even half of it. It's 90% of it. Mm-hmm. And again, if we can do that, then we're going to be able to focus even more on prevention, because we're getting a lot of older kids that are coming from other systems, from other providers that just don't know. And it's not that they're doing a bad job. It's just that they just don't know. And until they're given that education and that knowledge and that training, then we can expect something different, right?
Yeah. And that's a great way to really think about how to broaden what that team looks like. I think we're also used to thinking of a team as being in the same center, in the same place. Mm-hmm. And Everybody's got to configure their own team in their own way because that's kind of the nature of where we're at. But I love the idea of being able to also be that team to the pediatrician and that frontline provider as well. That's a great trend. Are there any other trends in terms of where you see PFD and ARFID treatment going? I was hearing a lot of the prevention talk, a lot of this team talk. What other trends do you think maybe where we're headed or where you want to see us go as a field?
I think the other, whether this is just my own like personal values coming out, I think something that I have been doing with some of, I know we've been talking about prevention, but we still have a consultation program that will still see some of the older kids. And oftentimes, the first question that I'm asking now is, what do you guys want as a family? I know that, your kid is 4, 6, 8, 10 at this point. You have been on this road for a really long time, right? You've seen X number of providers. You've been in feeding therapy for X number of years. You've done all of these things, and yet you're still here in front of me. What do you want? Do you want this? Do you, what are your values as a family? What do you think your kid needs? Where are they realistically from like a nutritional standpoint? Do you want to continue on this road, or is this something that you think that you need to be doing because other people are have been encouraging you? Sometimes it's a no, right? And that significantly shifts my goals as a provider. Because then my goals shift from how can we change this or how can we increase volume or variety or whatever to are we meeting baseline nutritional goals so your child can thrive from just like a nutritional and health and wellness standpoint, again, taking more of that holistic view. Are they able to participate in sports? Are they able to, focus in school? Like, what does this actually look like? And if the answer is no, okay, let's have a conversation about what is your bandwidth realistically? You told me no, you don't want to do all of this, but there's still this gap. So let's work together to find that middle ground. And sometimes when I've talked to, sorry.
Oh no, because sometimes families just need permission to be able to set their own goals.
I've had so many parents cry after this question. They just cry. And they say, I've never been asked that before.
Yeah, that would
And
be
I never would have asked that if I hadn't had my own kids, right? Because I used to be that provider that I was like, I know what you need. You need this, this, this. We're gonna do timers and we're gonna do structure and we're gonna do this, and I've got this, right? And I've just completely shifted my approach. And I think, I'll be honest, there are some providers that I've talked to about this that they don't like me very much. They don't like me very much at all because it is against their training and it's again, it's like, but what you can do this. I'm like, well, I know I can do this, but I don't know that I should do this. And that's a really big thing that I often ask myself is, I can, but should I? And I want to make sure that everybody is on the same page. And I think, that is, I'm hoping that could maybe be a trend, is again taking a step back and looking this at this holistically. And this is where Melissa's expertise also comes into play, is that we're really considering too, what does the kid look like in all of this? Right? How are they functioning with all of these therapies and all of these interventions? And maybe sometimes, more often than not, the most powerful intervention that we can work on, as long as they're nutritionally, I'm assuming in this situation, they're medically fine, we're not under any sort of, urgent crisis where they're malnourished, right? We're operating on this assumption here, that we just take a step back. And we really focus on that relationship because co-regulation and relationships are important outside of infancy. And sometimes that's been lost. And that's like Melissa's area where she shines. And, that's where I'm like, this is a, please take over here because I can see it now. But I'll admit with my training, I'm not the best person at
That's where the
the,
yin to your yang comes into play. What are your
Yes,
thoughts on that, Melissa?
well, I was just about to joke. I think it was one of the patients that Natalie saw today that I actually ended up, I saw them first, and then, for lots of reasons, it was appropriate to transition over to Natalie. And I mean, she spent how much time talking about how I was too, I don't know, fluffy. You got too feeling. I talk too much about feelings, which,
Yeah.
well, that's debatable. But yes, that is definitely where I think I tend to gravitate to. But I will tell you, yes, I have not been a favorite of a lot of providers as well, because I am very often saying more is not better. In fact, it can be worse, because it doesn't happen in a vacuum. This impacts the entire family system and dynamic, and it doesn't just happen inside the context of feeding, and then it's completely different otherwise. It bleeds into itself, and it's a dynamic and cumulative effect. And when stress is at play, there is oftentimes the inability to be able to grow and progress. And I can't even tell you how many times I've seen kids actually take off, and parents, their stress just improves so much when we just say, let's back off, let's take a break, let's just let them do their thing. It's hard for a lot of families also to let go, because they think they're giving up. I hear a lot of, I just gave up, I just was like, forget it, and a week later the kid's eating carrots at daycare. Actually, that's going to be one of a little bit of a I guess a
Teaser.
peak teaser. Yeah, that's going to be one of the examples we give. But it's true, because the pressure is gone. They're able to actually explore, enjoy, do or not do, but they're able to just be able to do what they need. And they oftentimes, when the right, when it's in the right condition, it will happen if the right things are in place, if you have that foundational piece in there. But I think one of the things also that came to mind as you guys, as we were talking about what direction, we're really hoping to go, I really hope that we start viewing feeding not just as a behavior, but as a developmental, again, like a developmental milestone. This is part of development. It's developmental. It's, all of the pieces that go into other developmental milestones really need to go into this as well. And it's not just based on age or what they should or shouldn't be doing. So much pressure and misconception is placed on, whether or not they're doing something by a certain age. And I think that's where a lot of things go wrong, because if you don't have the right goals, if you don't have the right expectations, you're not going to give the right experiences. You're not going to have the right, you're going to be more stressed because they're not doing something we shouldn't even be expecting them to do anyway. And that goes back to Natalie's, the focus on what's right for them, what's right for this family, because doing this at this point or ever might not be right for this family, and that's okay. And I think just really accepting there is a really broad range of what's okay and what's normal for feeding, I think would go a long way.
Yeah, and you are really listening to the family to be able to set that tone. And I think that, to your point, is a great trend of where this is going. It also pivots us to our final question. But before we get into that, I just thank you so much for sharing your experiences, for being open and honest and transparent about how your evolution and journey looked to how you're supporting families. And what does that look like to try to transform the field over the next several years to decades? Not only for families that are already in your program right now, but those that are on the wait list and those that are yet to come. And so thank you so much for your time today. For our last question, what do you think are the barriers to patient and family-centered research, and what might be potential solutions?
I think it kind of goes along with how different it's very multidisciplinary, and different disciplines take different lenses, have different even, philosophies, different orientations. And it's very, very difficult, especially from a research perspective, to make a lot of that kind of come together and kind of meld. And so I think that's a big, big barrier because feeding is so truly interdisciplinary and there is something to all of it. If there wasn't, then there wouldn't be those disciplines and expertise, right, in those areas of research. So I think that's, I think, one of the biggest things that would be great to really try to address and come together on. I think Feeding Matters has done a beautiful job of bringing all of the disciplines and being so inclusive and bringing all the disciplines together. So, I'm hoping that that will continue to, expand into the research area.
Thank you.
Yay.
Yeah,
Natalie, anything
I
else? Did I miss anything?
No, that was beautiful. I have nothing to
Well,
add.
I appreciate that too. Just because it's hard to bust silos. I think I even noticed in myself how I've evolved and how you have to even question your own stuff and what does it take to listen and are we missing anybody? And you can invite people to the table. They won't always sit at the table, but maybe over time they will. And we'll just continue to start working towards something that's shared in terms of understanding and shared in terms of values.
Think about
So,
it all the time.
yes, so true. Well, thank you, everyone. And thank you to those of you listening. We hope that you consider joining us on August 22nd for the Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit so we can bust those silos and learn from each other. So, thank you, everyone. Have a great one.
Thank you.